Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
You know, create a more egalitarian society, strong public education, strong public medicine. You know, all of the institutions that we know help level the playing field for every single citizen. This is the time for us to strengthen them, the time for us to tighten gun laws that are, you know, normalized, to really ensure that mass killings will continue, that access to fully automatic weapons, whose only purpose is to murder large numbers of people. It seems like a kind of a cultural suicide not to address those issues.
That's the voice of Dr. Darren Lund. On this week's show, we talked to Dr. Lund about the recent Vegas shooting and his perspectives on how to strengthen society and move forward in a more healthy way. So stay tuned.
You're listening to Latin Waves. We are very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Darren Lund. He's the professor at the University of Calgary and a prolific author. His latest book, The Great White North, which was co-authored with Paul Carr, was a seminal work for understanding privilege. He has two new books coming up. International Manual on Service Learning for Social Justice will be coming out in 2018. And his critical multicultural perspectives on whiteness comes out this fall. We're very privileged to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Sylvia. It's a pleasure.
When we think about the world, there are multiple ways we can see the world. Einstein say you can see the world as if everything's a miracle, as if nothing is. For me, I think that is a beautiful perspective if you are someone that never has to worry about all the other barriers faced in terms of how do we see ourselves in society. So let's begin talking about this world that is defined along the lines of success, mainly in terms of financial gain, social connection, mainly in terms of how connected we are to our immediate family or friends. How does privilege play a role in all of these relations, in all our relations?
Privilege plays a pivotal role. I mean, based on our identities and how we're socialized into those identities, you know, we learn a lot of subconscious kind of lessons our whole lives. It's never spelled out. Usually privilege isn't talked about by those who hold it, but it's always at play, and sometimes in very subtle ways, and, you know, sometimes in very overt ways that really can't be denied. And I really enjoy, when I'm teaching, having those uncomfortable conversations about privilege and having people rethink their lives. I mean, just like I am still on that journey, obviously, rethinking the narratives, the stories we tell about ourselves and the way we've seen ourselves and those around us are all heavily imbued with privilege. And to go back and listen to our stories again, but recognize all the times that our racialized privilege, or able-bodied privilege, male privilege, heterosexual privilege, anything that you know, has previously been either denied or hidden, when that is laid bare, I think it really, really reminds us of how strong a force privilege is in, you know, our access to resources and our negotiating this complex social world we're in.
You know, when I was thinking about our interview, I was mourning, you know, the loss of the recent massacre in Vegas. It's the largest, I guess, the most, the deadliest massacre in recent history in the United States. You know, over 500 people wounded, 60 dead. And I can't help to think about this wounded world that we live in. You know, it's wounded not just by the rift of colonial wounds, right, of markings that have defined some people as belonging, others as outsiders. It's wounded by the constant shifting sense of imperialism that normalizes inequality, you know, it normalizes disastrous storms and massacres as a new normal of the way things are. So yeah. In many ways, what we see doesn't touch us unless it somehow has a connection to us. One of my coworkers opened his email last Saturday and he said, "Look, this is what I woke up today." And then they said, "Oh my God, we can't find her. We can't find her." And then the email drops and says, "Oh my God, she's on the floor. She got shot." And we hear the news, we see the news, and somehow, you know, in this upside down world, we just feel numb. How do we reconcile?
Very good. Yeah. Very good depiction of the effect of all of this news, yeah. A numbness.
But numbness is also a feeling. You know, I never used to think of numbness as being a feeling. And to me, numbness is a way of feeling this sense of loss of power. In many ways, the shootings, the massacre, is also a depiction of the mass fear that engulfs our society today. Recently elected in the U.S., President Donald Trump, and there is a wave of symbolism and signals that come with that election. How do you deconstruct what we are living in a way that allows us to still remember who we are, you know, remember our connection?
Right. And that is the question. How can we retain the connections and the commitments that we know are important to living a healthy, robust, you know, connected life with a lot of love and a lot of care for others, when we're constantly surrounded by images from someone who's a leader or supposed to be a leader that are so vitriolic, so hateful, so narrow, and we think, you know, it's almost cartoon-like. But the reality is that, you know, he was elected by people who heard that message and it resonated something in them. So I think there is an entrenched sense of fear among some people that they are losing their power, you know, and I believe it's people who are fearful of a world that embraces diversity, that looks for the strength in every single person, and moves away from division and into unity. But that voice and those feelings, I think, are real, and they are, you know, they have grown, and we've heard them louder in recent months, and especially in the last couple of years, and certainly symbolically reflected in so many acts of violence and so many really blatant displays of hatred and terrorism, of really hatred and violence. And I think through all of that, you know, we maybe begin by feeling numb, or begin by just feeling despair and feeling that this is the new normal and this is the reality. But in our hearts and deep down, you know, our commitments to social justice and our commitments to love and to helping others and to, you know, working together to a better world, I think remain, you know, and they get suppressed for some time, or, you know, we have moments of hopelessness. But I think through all of it, you know, we have to just remind ourselves that, you know, each one of us still has agency, each one of us, and collectively, we still have so much power, and that our voice, the voices of people who do wish to see a more loving, connected world, really will prevail. You know, we have to have hope that they can and will prevail, and that the strong work that's going on through the protests that you see, that really well-coordinated efforts, the individual heroic efforts, the love and care we saw, even at that shooting, those moments of humanity that we saw, that's what we need to focus on. You know, when there's flames all around, or when there's guns, you know, bullets raining down, we still have to focus on, you know, those people that are self-sacrificial in a way, even to looking out more for the lives of others than for themselves. That's the hope that we have. That's the humanity we need to keep striving to build. And that means actively, politically, and socially becoming engaged and resisting the kinds of hate and violence that we see.
Now, in our society, it's very easy to label someone who commits a crime of this nature a terrorist. But in the case of Vegas, the shooter was not declared a terrorist. You know, this was not declared an act of domestic terror. How would you explain that?
Yeah, I think the explanation comes down to a fairly simple matter of his skin color, really, how we see him, how society sees him. His fact of being a white middle-aged man immediately absolves him from any possible links to terrorism. Even if he were highly linked to some militia or some hate groups, it is very, very unlikely that anyone, any media or even in just the public consciousness, would label him as a terrorist. That word is so racialized that it is, you know, I mean, ISIS claims this and most other acts of violence as their own, but it's never believed when it's a white person, but it is almost immediate if a person of color. There recently was an act in Edmonton, Alberta, where a man drove a vehicle into a police officer and into some innocent people. You know, the fact that he was from the Somali community, immediately it was, you know, suspected terrorist activity in Edmonton. You know, that it really, as a baby, and he was not affiliated with, as far as we know, a terrorist group, but we just watch how his identity just affords him that status immediately.
So in many ways, I think that being able to reclaim ourselves also begins with being able to understand the nuances that we have taken as common sense. And perhaps you can illuminate us a little bit. In your book, you describe very lucidly the way privilege occupies such an elusive space and yet is prevalent in affirming and granting power to some and denying others their own power.
Yeah. I mean, the Great White North, the book you're talking about, exploring whiteness, privilege, and identity in education, it really was, you know, born from Paul Carr and I just being surrounded by amazing scholars of just a range of identities and backgrounds, and really thinking about how pervasive whiteness is and just this social construction of whiteness and the lived reality of whiteness, how important it is to not just name it and not just acknowledge that it's there and exists, but also to begin deconstructing or countering it in some very specific ways. And so for that, we invited a number of our colleagues and other folks, community activists, indigenous friends and colleagues to, you know, add their voice and their perspectives to how can we best begin this or continue this task of not just naming whiteness, but countering it and seeing how we can illuminate this and other aspects of our privilege to really acknowledge the uneven playing field that we've been on, just this false meritocracy that we're living in, believing that if you just work hard enough, you'll get everything you deserve or want and need. But in fact, the barriers for some and the hurdles for others, you know, and the advantages for others are so extreme that it's definitely worthy of continued analysis and activism.
When we think about the world we are co-creating, I immediately think of our children, of the way we educate. And your book points out how education is perhaps one of the first places we learn the authority that privilege asserts, you know, and these ways of dismissing right? This ways of affirming merit as the marker of success, as the way that some people tend to gain access to possibilities and resources that allows them to elevate their lives, and others are simply shrunk. And for me, I think that having an indigenous body, we reclaim those identities by reconciling our own histories of who we are, where we come from, who our lineages are. But when you're white, we assume the white has no color. And what's the power in having no color?
Well, I think it's just that assumed normalcy, that racelessness that never has to be named or mentioned, even when, we want it to, or when we have strong cultural affiliations or strong ethnic affiliations, as I know I do. But the privilege of not needing to know your history or not needing to, overcome colonial oppression and imperialism as part of your cultural past really just means that it is a tremendous privilege, and it is never being asked where you're really from, or never never being questioned of how Canadian you are. It is a privilege that is really strongly tied to identity and strongly tied to belonging, and to deserving, right? Who deserves to be here and who deserves the resources of this place, and the silencing of the other voices that have, that learn that they have less value. And we can see just in the, brutal symbolic situation with murdered and missing Indigenous women in Canada, not just dozens, hundreds, even thousands of lives that we don't know about, that had, no voice, that had no agency, that their families knew they were missing. And these women's lives, as mainstream Canada just kind of turns a blind eye, and that clearly some lives are worth more than other lives, that we learn this lesson that not every person is born with the same access to resources and to, even the same basic human rights.
After the massacre in Vegas, the senator for the White House spoke up and said, "This is not the time to talk about guns. This is the time to come together." And I think it's very telling, right? How we dismiss the issue. Why talk about guns at a moment when people are impacted by it? Why talk about natural disasters at a moment when we're being ravaged by storms and hurricanes? Why talk about the destruction of Mother Earth at a moment when our economic systems are collapsing and the market can't seem to regulate itself in the way that we were promised it would do? Why talk about it now, when people want to hear, when people are engaged, and we can co-create change? So in so many ways, I think that the status quo, the way things are, this common sense way of sustaining the economy, the political system, democracy, as we call it, is also a way of silencing what is urgent for us to speak, what is essential for us to speak. How do you explain that to your students? Because they say, "Well, it's always been this way. I was born into it. Yeah. Don't blame me for it."
Don't blame me for what my ancestors did, or don't blame me for what my, the predecessors created. We're just living in this system, and it's not my fault. But each one of us, benefits or is subjugated by these same, these conditions that carry on, but they're not immutable. They're not unchangeable. These conditions are all part of systems created by people. And we do have agency and power to make changes. And, sometimes those have to come from grassroots efforts, The powers that be, as you say, actively seek to maintain the status quo for their own economic gain, usually, or political or social gain. So the idea that, no, this is not the time to talk about it, as you said, those are pivotal questions, because this is exactly the time we need to talk about it. This is the time when we do need activism and political will and political power to make the changes that we need to make to create a stronger social fabric in our society, to support the health and mental health of vulnerable people, to support the institutions that do tend to, you know, create a more egalitarian society, strong public education, strong public medicine, you know, all of the institutions that we know help level the playing field for every single citizen. This is the time for us to strengthen them, the time for us to tighten gun laws that are, you know, normalized, to really ensure that mass killings will continue, that access to fully automatic weapons, whose only purpose is to murder large numbers of people. It seems like a kind of a cultural suicide not to address those issues head on and in very politically expedient strategic ways right now.
You know, in your book, you use a metaphor that I absolutely love. And you said, if you bought a house and your house had a faulty furnace, you wouldn't just say, oh, it came with a faulty furnace. You do something about it. So your latest book is about the International Manual on Service Learning for Social Justice. How can we avail ourselves of the tools we already have to fix the furnace, perhaps through the service learning, perhaps through the movement to creating more reciprocal ways of learning and sharing knowledge with each other? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And service learning is a fairly new field, but it's, you know, it comes out of a long history of, you know, this kind of a colonial service where you're arriving somewhere to help, right? And that help can take many forms, not all of which benefit the people who are purportedly the targets of that help or the benefactors of that help. So I think what a number of us in the field that are doing community engaged kind of projects have come to what we call, my co-editor or my assistant editor and I, Kari Green from UBC, and I speak of as the social justice turn. And that is that there's an acceptance that you can no longer create these kind of savior mentality projects where these folks are lucky to have us here and we come in with our Western ways of knowing and impose, just yet another colonial project, that to do service learning, to be in this field means to come in with a cultural humility. So instead of cultural competency where I need to learn everything about you to do my job better or to get credentials, instead, we turn that around to say, I need to be humble in the face of the other and say, what can I learn from this person or this group of people? And then build projects collaboratively based on that. So the authors that are contributing to this, the Wiley International Handbook on Service Learning for Social Justice, have done just that and talked about the actual projects they've built, either with, you know, underprivileged urban kids or with indigenous groups, working, you know, with indigenous scholars and on all kinds of local and international service learning projects that really have social justice at the core. And it's not like we've got it right. It's really just that there's this recognition that we need to do better.
Thank you so much for being with us today. I think that what I've learned so much from you is that, to me, hope is not a good action plan, You know, it's for us in Latin America, we say that hope is an active, inspired action that we take based on our relationships to the land, our relationships to each other, our relationships to the values that we cherish, you know, the values of integrity, the values of community and love that, you know, propel us, you know, not just as an individual, but also as a community, as a world. We are all one, you know, I mean, we're all dependent on one another. And our interdependence must be reflected in the ways that we walk and see and, you know, share with each other and see each other. What would be your parting words for our audience? You know, what would you leave us for? And, you know, in terms of your inspiration, what inspires you now? What moves you? And what possibilities do you see in the horizons?
Yeah, that's such a good picture. And I should give credit to here that furnace metaphor of the moving into a house with a broken furnace was from a talk I heard by Carl James, my friend and colleague at York University. But it is kind of a reminder of we're all living here together, and there is something wrong. There are a lot of things wrong. And we, you know, it's not just noticing it, facing it, but the fact that collectively we actually can address these things. And I like, you know, some people will say, well, I'm not an activist, or I don't see myself as very political, but it's all political. And the thing to recognize is if you're doing nothing, or if you're just staying in a position of numbness or despair, then you are already an activist. You're an activist for the status quo, in which there are a lot of inequities. So I like to remind students and remind myself too that doing nothing, you know, is not an option, but that just looking for how much positive change we can make in building more equitable schools, in building more socially just programs and programming and aspects of all aspects of our life. Whether it's medical care, mental health care, working with, you know, any populations or businesses that are really embracing a more humane way of being in the world that doesn't elevate profits above people. These are actions we can continue to take and that we can feed, right? So we need to use this current climate of, you know, with some public shows of hate and violence, and use that to really remember the alternative, and that is connection and love, and to keep fighting for those values in every single thing we do every day, with whether it's with our own families, with our immediate colleagues and coworkers, people in our own community, or people across the world. I think to remind ourselves that, you know, together all of us can create a better world, and it starts today.
Thank you so much for being with us. That was Dr. Darren Lund. His latest book, The International Manual on Service Learning for Social Justice, comes out next spring, 2018. And his book, Critical Perspectives on Whiteness, comes out this fall. So look for it. Thank you again for being with us today.
Thanks again, Sylvia. Take care.
Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.